lots of them all over the world, who crack me up and fill me with hope, and who blessedly manage to forget about my title once we start rooting around in the dirt of a garden. Since stepping reluctantly into public life, I've been held up as the most powerful woman in the world and taken down as an angry Black woman. I've wanted to ask my detractors which part of that phrase matters to them the most. Is it angry, or Black, or woman? I've smiled for photos with people who call my husband horrible names on national television, but still want a framed keepsake for their mantle. I've heard about the swampy parts of the internet that question everything about me, right down to whether I'm a woman or a man. A sitting U.S. congressman has made fun of my butt. I've been hurt. I've been furious. But mostly, I've tried to laugh the stuff off. There's a lot I still don't know about America, about life, about what the future might bring. But I do know myself. My father, Frazier, taught me to work hard, laugh often, and keep my word. My mother, Marion, showed me how to think for myself and to use my voice. Together, in our cramped apartment on the south side of Chicago, they helped me see the value in our story, in my story, in the larger story of our country. Even when it's not pretty or perfect, even when it's more real than you want it to be, your story is what you have, what you will always have. It's something to own. For 8 years, I lived in the White House, a place with more stairs than I can count, plus elevators, a bowling alley, and an in-house florist. I slept in a bed that was made up with Italian linens. Our meals were cooked by a team of world-class chefs and delivered by professionals more highly trained than those at any five-star restaurant or hotel. Secret Service agents, with their earpieces and guns and deliberately flat expressions, stood outside our doors, doing their best to stay out of our family's private life. We got used to it, eventually, sort of. The strange grandeur of our new home, and also the constant quiet presence of others. The White House is where our two girls played ball in the hallways and climbed trees on the south lawn. It's where Barack sat up late at night, poring over briefings and drafts of speeches in the treaty room, and where Sonny, one of our dogs, sometimes pooped on the rug. I could stand on the Truman balcony and watch the tourists posing with their selfie sticks and peering through the iron fence, trying to guess at what went on inside. There were days when I felt suffocated by the fact that our windows had to be kept shut for security, that I couldn't get some fresh air without causing a fuss. There were other times when I'd be awestruck by the white magnolias blooming outside, the everyday bustle of government business, the majesty of a military welcome. There were days, weeks, and months when I hated politics. And there were moments when the beauty of this country and its people so overwhelmed me that I couldn't speak. Then it was over. Even if you see it coming, even as your final weeks are filled with emotional goodbyes, the day itself is still a blur. A hand goes on a Bible, an oath gets repeated, one president's furniture gets carried out while another's comes in. Closets are emptied and refilled in the span of a few hours. Just like that, there are new heads on new pillows, new temperaments, new dreams. And when it ends, when you walk out the door that last time from the world's most famous address, you're left in many ways to find yourself again. So let me start here with a small thing that happened not long ago. I was at home in the red brick house that my family recently moved into. Our new house sits about 2 miles from our old house on a quiet neighborhood street. We're still settling in. In the family room, our furniture is arranged the same way it was in the White House.